Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 16, 2019. This is the 12th week of our Tuesday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on dependent origination, the Paticca-samuppada of Abhanga Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So here we are at dependent origination. How many of you would say you have a workable understanding of dependent origination? Please show your hands. This one. Well, I thought you would. It's not all that terribly complicated when we have the right context, but it does take some learning. This is what the Buddha awaken to. This sutta describes the purpose of the Buddha's intention, which is to recognize and interrupt this ongoing process that's rooted in ignorance. So the Buddha awakened to this profound understanding excuse me, that it was ignorance, but a very specific type of ignorance. It is ignorance of four noble truths, timeless truths, that result in all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. When the Buddha left his home in search of understanding, it is specifically this that he was seeking understanding for. He wasn't looking for magical or mystical answers trying to understand all things. He was simply trying to understand and, if possible, eliminate suffering. He saw that as the central theme in human life. And if we look at it closely, that is the central theme of all of our lives, whether we realize it or not. We're always hoping to move away from anything that will take away from our pleasure, and we're always trying to build on those things that give us pleasure. And we're disappointed when we don't get our way, aren't we? And it is that direct and that practical, and it meets us at the point of contact. You'll notice as I go through this, and I'm going to try to finish the sutta tonight without rushing, but just for scheduling and logistical reasons, and we've been through it often, I think I can. But you'll see that each one of these 12 elements relates in some way to another important theme of the Dhamma, such as fabrications or corrupted views or wrong views, the underlying component of ignorance to all manner of suffering, the way that our thinking is impacted by fabrications, and you'll see as I go through the steps, and how we start creating self-identity, name and form, rooted in those fabrications rather than reality. And then how craving starts this, the visceral experience of suffering, and clinging continues, it maintains that. And the important thing to remember here is that the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, as it's shown up on whichever one of those graphs is the right one, that the Eightfold Path is taught to interrupt this 12-step process. And at any point in that process that we find recognition and understanding, we can cut the cord of ignorance and live free. Live free from all of these confused thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So let me begin. The Buddha was at Savatthi, at Jiva's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed those assembled. Friends, I will describe in detail dependent origination. Listen carefully. One of the significant things about by saying he will describe in detail, there are some treatments by the Buddha on dependent origination where there's only 9 steps, but if you look at the context he's teaching, it kind of makes sense. An interesting thing that you can do if you haven't done it already is go do a web search on dependent origination or dependent co-arising and look at the subsequent teaching, especially those that have video presentations, and compare it to what the Buddha actually taught. And you won't find anything that I've ever come across, I haven't looked in a while, that in any way resembles what the Buddha actually taught. And yet, we had a little discussion about this. It is from either a misunderstanding, misapplication, or a complete dismissal of dependent origination that has allowed for all the contradictory and confusing so-called dharmas. And if you maintain fidelity to this one teaching, you can't lose your way, and you won't create any kind of foolish teachings or practices. Friends, I will describe in detail dependent origination. Listen carefully. And what is dependent origination? From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. That's the beginning of it all. From ignorance. And remember, it's a very specific ignorance of four noble truths. From that ignorance comes a corrupted, perverted view of ourselves in relation to the world we live in. So we're already in trouble. From those fabrications, as a requisite condition, comes consciousness. And this is not going to sound good on the recording. This is ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's not some grand cosmic unity consciousness or anything like that. It's just ongoing thinking. And notice the requisite condition for that type of thinking. Fabrications. If we can clear ourselves of fabrications, then our thinking will be correct. And how do we do that? By abandoning ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So do you see how this builds? From that consciousness, from ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, as a requisite condition, comes name and form. Name and form, the Pali word is namarupa, but it simply means self-identification with this form. I'm giving a name to this form, and I'm calling, in my case, I'm calling it John. Sometimes I called it Mickey Mantle, sometimes I called it Joe Lewis, but it's John. This is who I identify with. And once I create a fabricated view of me, use a strong word, I'm condemned to protect and defend this. And because it's rooted in fabrication, it can bring nothing but stress. How could it not? From name and form, from self-identification as a requisite condition, comes the sixth sense base. Now notice, this isn't a creation myth, although many people want to make it such. It simply describes the process of a mind rooted in ignorance, but in a human body, prone to feelings and thoughts, how that human being ends up in confused and with deluded thinking, prone to suffering. From self-identification as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. So the Buddha's not teaching that simply because I'm self-identifying that I've now created senses. That's not what the Buddha's teaching. Within this body, remember the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, the four elements, the fifth element of space, and the sixth property of consciousness is what a human being is. So what are we doing with it as a human being if our minds are rooted in fabrication? Now when we come in contact with the world through the sixth sense base, remember my consciousness is already rooted in fabrications and misperceiving things, but now something comes into contact, what can I do with that? I can only perceive it from a point of view of ignorance. In other words, I misperceive it. I create a fabrication over an initial fabrication from not seeing things clearly. Is that clear? So again, at the point of contact is where my ignorance starts to manifest. How else would it with a psychophysical being? At the point of contact, and you've heard me say this so many times, and it is at that same point that we practice the Dhamma, at the point of contact. Because that's where ignorance is manifesting. It's also where we start, incorporating knowledge and wisdom at the point of contact, beginning right view. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that really is as simple and direct as right view is. Those are confusing at first because we don't have the context. This is the context. Apply your developing right view, free of fabrication, at the point of contact, where we're making self-identification. And when we do that from the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. And I should also mention, this is not a process that we can track in time. In other words, it doesn't take 5 minutes for this part of it and 10 minutes for that and 12 minutes for that and six. This happens so quickly and in such a familiar way that we don't catch it. We don't see it. So you can say that it happens outside of time, but the manifestation is obviously within linear time, within ignorance. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. I simply have to have senses if I'm going to contact anything, don't I? Or else I'm just an immaterial nothing, ether. So I've engaged my senses to start interacting and interpreting the world that I'm living in but my mind is still rooted in fabrication. And so now as contact takes place and my mind is rooted in fabrications from that contact, as a requisite condition, in other words, there has to be contact. There has to be contact in this process, a contact that is arising from a fabricated view. From contact in that scenario, as a requisite condition, comes feeling. So our whole human experience is based on feeling, isn't it? And if our whole human experience that is based on feeling is rooted in fabrications themselves, rooted in ignorance, what kind of life can we have? It's going to be pretty stressful, won't it? Simply because we don't know what's going on. We don't know where these feelings are coming from or why I'm having these feelings or who to blame for these feelings. Rather than having an impersonal understanding that it's just a feeling.
And you may not even recognize it as stressful. Because it's happening continually, that it just might be a shadow of something that makes your stomach feel different.
Yep.
And the next moment you can be happy.
And since we don't want to recognize that in this moment my stomach is a little queasy and I'm unhappy, let me find something to distract me. And so that's what establishes, that's clinging and maintaining. That I don't, another aspect of clinging is I don't want to have these butterflies in my stomach right now. That's still clinging. It's still desire. And so that mind that is now reacting to what's occurring is also reinforcing through the reaction, self-identifying with it. Do you see? Mm-hmm. And so we are literally building a human being called me out of fabrications, out of whole cloth. There's nothing there. And yet we insist that it is. And really, I shouldn't say there's nothing. What is there is the six properties that make up a human being. With that, we can do whatever we want. So we might as well develop a calm and peaceful mind rooted in understanding of four noble truths, I say. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. Makes sense, doesn't it? I first have to have something to crave before I can start craving. But now that I have, now that I've established what I need to be happy and what I need to avoid to stay happy, I crave after those things. Why? Because I've now self-identified with them. Name and form. Do you see the progression?
Mm-hmm.
Rooted in ignorance. Now that craving has started in me, from that craving as a requisite condition, comes clinging and maintaining. So if I can figure out a way to eliminate craving, eliminate desire, clinging and maintaining falls away, doesn't it? And so what's the problem? What initiates that craving? Self-identification. I'm making rooted in what? Fabrications. So we've had this discussion off and on. At times, it feels like we're letting go of everything if we let go of this fabricated self, doesn't it? But it's like the Buddha says, it's foam on the ocean. It's really just all we're letting go is the root of all our troubles.
Mm-hmm.
What's left is a highly functional, always present human being. Always at peace with what's occurring. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition, I have to hold on to these views. It's something that I have to actively engage in. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. Hence the name of the book. There's never a qualification for this becoming in any translation. But what in the context, and this is a lot of people go off the rails on this, as this is the jumping off point that we can become all kinds of different things. Look at the context of Buddha's teaching here. It starts with ignorance. What is he referring to from clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition? The only thing he could be referring to is becoming further ignorant if we cling and maintain fabrications. Following me? Everybody? All right? Good. So it is again, this is another point that we can recognize and abandon. The Buddha refers to an awakened human being, the quality of their mind is at peace and as released from fabricated views, relates directly to dependent origination. So when we let go of and start dismantling this process, then this moment holds the potential to become awakened. If we ignore this, if we continue ignorance of Four Noble Truths, then every moment of our life, the only real potential it has is to become further ignorant. Hence the Eightfold Path that interrupts this ongoing process. hoping to change, wishing to change, hoping to gain merit, chanting ourselves, ritualizing ourselves, doesn't work, according to the Buddha. But what does work is this simple and effective Eightfold Path. From becoming as a requisite condition, meaning if we continue ignorance, from becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. The first time the Buddha references, and this is, again, this is where creationists go off the rails. They say, well, the Buddha's teaching this is how we're born. There's nothing in here about human birth, is there? Again, the context is important. What are we giving birth to? If we are not addressing the problem of a mind rooted in ignorance, we're giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. That's the birth the Buddha's talking about. It's the Buddha's not teaching, and it, you know, I don't know anybody could take it this way, but some do, that because of ignorance, my mother gave birth. It doesn't matter. We're here. A process that is completely unimportant to being here, and as far as the Dhamma is concerned, is not referenced by the Buddha, is it? He doesn't have to get into how babies are made. A baby's been made, and this baby is confused. This baby is deluded. This baby's worried about the flash on his glasses. Dukkha occurs. I am over upset. It doesn't bother. In fact, I think it's pretty cool. Dukkha occurs because dukkha has occurred in my life because I've done nothing. Didn't know I had to, but I've done nothing to address my own ignorance of the way things are. I was talking to actually he's a new student now, but he may be coming on a retreat. When I was 13, 14, 15, 16, I was even earlier, 3, 4, 5, I was incredibly frustrated and angry with my life simply because it didn't make any sense. And I just felt like the things that people were telling me I should do and hold as important just really seemed like nonsense, even though a lot of it was I should have taken more seriously. But because of that simple lack of understanding, in other words, if somebody had taught me the Four Noble Truths and dependent origination when I was 13, I could have resolved a lot of issues in my life, but I didn't understand the way things were. So I kept grasping after things to satisfy that ignorance, which is really what we do. We become compulsive. And we also, whether we realize it or not, that name and form becomes insatiable with maintaining itself. And so we continually create strategies and scenarios to ignore that initial ignorance and keep becoming further ignorant. And as David was pointing out, it's not always apparent, is it? We keep achieving things, some people, and the more so-called successful we become, it's almost, for many people, we become even more removed from our own suffering, don't we? Excuse me. So there's really no inner motivation to change. There's no real suffering. We've done a good job of masking our suffering, haven't we? And it's not just people that are successful. People that aren't quite as successful come up with different scenarios to ignore their own ignorance. And all of those, if you think about that, any one of those strategies that we might employ, that I might employ to continue my own ignorance, is the strategy I'm using to ignore ignorance. Mm. Whatever that might be. Is that clear?
Yeah.
So it could be that I find great distraction in bowling. And so now that I'm bowling, I can't wait to have a 300 game. And so most of my thinking now is going to be geared towards that Thursday night bowling league. And I might decide that, you know, I could use a couple extra practice bowls on Monday and Tuesday and maybe over the weekend. And maybe I should, you know, I'm getting a little bit silly. But so now I'm obsessed with being a 300 bowler because I've created an identity over it. What possible meaning could it have in the world to become a 300 bowler except that I need people to know that I've bowled a 300 game? Or pick anything else that we use to distract ourselves. And that doesn't mean that if we enjoy bowling, we shouldn't go bowling. We just shouldn't use it for eye making. One of my teachers many years ago, I thought I was going to get through this tonight, his name was Arnold Patton, and he taught some things that had similar teachings to the Buddha, but not entirely. But he loved tennis. And he went through his own kind of awakening process, but not really to what the Buddha taught. And he, so he continued to play tennis, but he didn't like the competitive nature of it. And he found three other buddies, and they played non-competitive tennis. Their whole point was just to keep the ball going over the net. They had a great time, and they got their great exercise playing non-competitive tennis. The most fun time I ever had on the golf course was by myself at, you know, 6:30, 7 o'clock at night, all alone out there, just hitting balls for the pure pleasure. You know, if you play golf, there's nothing like that feeling when you just hit one, you know. It's just, and so there it was. And that was enough for me. I enjoyed that much more than the competitive golf that I used to do. All right. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, or regret, pain, distress, and despair. As simply as a consequence of having a human life, we're going to have those experiences. But when we give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance, we are making ourselves prone to reacting to or not accepting aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. Those are all common experiences of human life. But if my mind is rooted in ignorance, those common experiences, which shouldn't give me any stress at all, can prove very stressful. So now the Buddha describes in slightly more detail and in reverse order each of the 12 links, kind of undoing the process. Now, what is aging and death? Aging is decrepitude, brokenness, graying, decline, weakening of the faculties. Death is the passing away of the five clinging aggregates: form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness. Upon death, there's no effect from that personal experience of suffering rooted in ignorance. It's not an escape, though. Death is the passing away of the five clinging aggregates, the ending of time, the interruption of the life faculties. That's such an important line, and I don't think I've ever heard anybody even comment on it or mention it. When the Buddha's teaching that we get this life to deal with this, and he's not making any promises about any other opportunity.
But he calls it the interruption.
The interruption of the end. Interruption of the life faculties. So the inference is, if you don't want to get caught up in this whole process again, engage with the Eightfold Path.
So whether he believes in rebirth or not, if you pass and not take into the practice, all you can do is repeat it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He doesn't deny that. But he never teaches any way to manipulate that. He just says the point of the Dhamma is to awaken in this lifetime and not leave the residual karma, we'll get into that in 2 weeks, that causes more suffering. And we see it as another human opportunity to awaken. That's not how the Buddha sees it. You're just simply caught back in the same trap you were. And there's no guarantee that you're going to get out then as opposed to now. So you might as well do it now. Now, what is birth? This is interesting. Birth is the descent, the coming forth, the coming to be. Remember, in the context of this sutta, ignorance of Four Noble Truths leads to suffering. Birth is the appearance, remember just a few steps ago, birth is the appearance of the sixth sense base. The appearance of the sixth sense base is the appearance of the manifestation of suffering. Just as a human being in a physical birth is now manifesting on the planet as a human being, as an infant, ignorance is manifesting in this moment of birth of ignorance. Ignorance is born at the point of the sixth sense base being interpreted by consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Is that clear? That's the birth that the Buddha is talking about. That's the kind of birth that I have control over, even as a man. What I give birth to in the next moment is entirely up to me, and it's entirely up to all of you and everyone else. It's my choice. I got to stop blaming the situation, the world, the president, the Democrats, the Republicans, my spouse, my dog, everyone. I have to do, this is one of the most difficult things when people finally realize it. A self-referential ego personality has an ongoing out. It's never really responsible for anything because it's not real. But someone developing the Dhamma has to take radical responsibility for everything that occurs to them, and ultimately every thought, word, and idea that flows through that consciousness. Difficult for some. Birth is the appearance of the sixth sense base and the five clinging aggregates. Now, what is becoming? Becoming is sensual. Becoming is sensual becoming, form becoming, and formless becoming. That's that, again, briefly, the formless becoming the Buddha's talking about is establishing yourself in non-physical planes. And we went through all that. Everybody understands that? That's what he means by formless becoming. It's still rooted in ignorance. And what is clinging and maintaining? There are four types of clinging. Clinging to sensory stimulus, clinging to views or conditioned thinking, clinging to precepts and practices, and clinging to a doctrine of self. And all of those could be variants of clinging to a doctrine of self. You could say that that's the Buddha saying, these are the things to not cling to. Views, precepts and practices, rituals. And precepts and practices is anything that you think you can do or should do or want to do or somebody's told you to do, that will bring you merit, that some disincarnate being or spiritual system is going to take notice and grant you something based on that. It just doesn't make any sense. And what is craving? There are six classes of craving. There's craving for forms, craving for sounds, craving for smells, craving for tastes, craving for physical sensations, and craving for ideas. Do you see how each and every one of those is reflective of the sixth sense base? Each and every one. The Buddha often talks about each one of our senses as having their own consciousness. In other words, there's eye consciousness, nose consciousness. Because we are perceiving, we are applying our consciousness through our senses. And in that way, that we are extrapolating consciousness within the sense. So when our minds are rooted in ignorance and fabricating the world around us, guess what, folks? We can't even really trust what we're seeing. Or hearing, or smelling, or tasting. It's certainly not wise to build an identity over things we're not really sure is even occurring. Can leave that one hanging. And what is feeling? Feeling has six classes as well. Feeling arising from eye contact, from ear contact, from nose contact, from taste contact, from body contact, from intellect contact. This is called feeling. So again, it's all at that point of contact that we practice the Dhamma. And what is contact? Phenomena contacting the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the intellect. And it's interesting, the treatment there. We don't really look at our thinking, our intellect, our consciousness as something, as a separate sense. But when you look at it this way, that it is ultimately my consciousness, my thinking, that I'm relating to the world through contact, that reinforces the idea that I better have some pretty good thinking, doesn't it? Do you understand what I'm saying here? That if my thinking is skewed at all, what I'm experiencing is going to be skewed. I won't be living in reality. I'll be living a fabricated reality. This is contact with the sixth sense base. And what is name and form? Feeling, perception, intention, attention, meaning all mental aspects, and contact. Discriminating self-referential consciousness is name. Just means that because of a fabricated view, I've self-identified with this. The elements of water, fire, earth, and wind, that which makes up physical form, is called form. Nothing personal here. Name and form is discriminating consciousness bound to or clinging to physical form. Does everybody understand that? Name and form is discriminating in the way that it's evaluating good, bad, indifferent.
Or me, not you.
Yes. Yes. Name and form is discriminating consciousness bound to or clinging to physical form. I'm bound to this. It's So and what the Buddha is referring to is, even though we know on some level, most people do, that the end will come for this, we don't really live that way. We perceive ourselves as being permanent beings, or we at least have taken on the belief that this John, whoever it is eternal. And we'll be, you know, after death, these kind of scenarios may take place, and I'll be okay. Mm-hmm. Buddha says, don't think that way. And what is consciousness? There are six classes of consciousness. There's eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and intellect consciousness. And what are fabrications? There are only three fabrications. There's bodily fabrications. The Buddha doesn't say only, I do. There are three fabrications. Bodily fabrications, verbal fabrications, and mental fabrications. In other words, it's all happening right here. And the importance of that teaching is the Buddha saying, stop looking outside of yourself. The answers aren't there. You are fabricating all of this within that you, within that name and form. And what is ignorance? If anybody's confused, ignorance is not knowing stress. Would anyone here say they know stress?
No.
At a profound and penetrative level?
No.
Yeah, so again, it's one. Every if I asked a question about impermanence, you would all say, yeah, I know what it means. We all know what stress means. But we haven't developed that profound and penetrative understanding of impermanence, or the three marks of existence, the not-self characteristic, and the resulting suffering. But that's what we experience through the Dhamma, if we keep our focus. And remember that what we're here to gain insight into is those three things, impermanence, the not-self-characteristic, and suffering. I'm going to go back one. Ignorance is not knowing stress, not knowing the origination of stress, meaning not knowing ignorance, not knowing the cessation of stress, meaning the Eightfold Path, not knowing the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of stress. This is called ignorance. So there's these very simple elements. If we want to resolve our ignorance, we can remember these. And this is really the goal. It's not, we can get lost in being ignorant of everything, which is another way of practicing the modern insight movement, which is to be mindful of every single thing that's occurring in your mind. Ignorance is not knowing stress, not knowing the origination of stress. We know what it is, ignorance. Not knowing the cessation of stress. And again, this relates directly to Four Noble Truths too, doesn't it? And not knowing that the Eightfold Path is the path leading to the cessation of stress. If we want to end stress and suffering in our lives, Eightfold Path. This is called ignorance. And Buddha continues, now from the remainderless, there's nothing left, from the remainderless fading and cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of fabrication. Directly cuts it off at the root. From the remainderless fading and cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of fabrication. From the cessation of fabrication comes the cessation of consciousness. Again, we don't lose the ability to think. It's simply now our consciousness is not rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. From the cessation of a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, consciousness, comes the cessation of self-identification, of name and form. It simply happens as a consequence of developing the Eightfold Path. This is the result of it. From the cessation of self-identification, from the cessation of conceit and eye-making, comes the cessation of the six-sense base. Again, it doesn't mean that now we no longer have any senses left once we're awakened. We're no longer using our senses to interpret the world through fabricated views rooted in ignorance. If you take this out of context, you really miss this, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to hold that in mind. We don't lose the ability to think or feel or touch or smell or taste or think. In fact, we really gain the ability to do so for the first time in reality. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. Again, the Buddha's not teaching that we stop feeling as human beings. We stop generating feelings that are rooted in ignorance and prone to bringing more stress in my life and more confusion. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. If there's no longer desire left in me, if there's no longer fear left in me, remember the Loka Sutta where there's desire, there's fear? once that's all gone, it's just a calm and peaceful mind present with my life as life occurs. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming. Excuse me. So the cessation of becoming means the cessation of ignorance is now gone, so I can no longer become further ignorant. I only have one choice, to become awakened. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of giving birth, comes the cessation of birth, or giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of sickness, aging, death, sorrow, pain, distress, despair, confusion, and confusion. Now, that doesn't mean that when one awakens, using the Buddha as an example, it doesn't mean you no longer age. It doesn't mean you're never going to have sickness. It doesn't mean that there won't be distress, maybe despair. But you'll cease reacting to it. And so it will no longer feed ignorance. It'll simply be part of having a human life.
Did Buddha experience restraint? Or was he beyond?
I would say, he practiced restraint constantly. And so even when, a good example again, the Buddha's life, he didn't escape aging, did he? He died at the age of 80. And he died a rather painful death from food poisoning, as it's described. So, and even that is described in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, that he was, you know, he had actual feelings of severe pain, and he actually died. You know, that
we
he
all share that.
Pardon me?
Well, we all share that. But did the Buddha get bothered by the guy beeping behind him?
There was often chariots behind the Buddha, but I have to answer in speculation. I would say no, but then from reading the suttas, there are times where you could see that the Buddha is more engaged with what's going on. and saying things like to Devadatta, using as an example, this is a foolish man. So he saw the world realistically. So I'm not sure if the Buddha was stuck in traffic and somebody was beeping their horn behind him. I doubt it would bother him. And I can tell you why I say that, because it doesn't bother me anymore. And it used to drive me crazy. I mean, I spent the first probably 10 or 15 years of my life driving with my head out the window and my hand most of the time too. A little bit more expression than that. if you got anywhere near me on the road, you know, you better back off. I don't do that anymore. In fact, I notice it when that kind of stuff doesn't bother me anymore. And it feels pretty good. I spent so many years thinking that other people needed me to tell them when they were doing things wrong. They hardly ever agreed when I finally caught up to them.
And you still have all your teeth.
Well, no, I don't. That's another story.
Yeah.
Thank you, David.
The word despair, however, you know, to go with David's question, would the Buddha have had despair?
I doubt it, because he would understand. You know, in other words, so he heard his father was dying. He got up and he walked the 140 miles to hopefully be with his dad before he died. But I think he just saw it as a practical, you know, this is just what happens. I don't think he was. And again, I tell from personal experience, my sister just died. I could cry a little bit. Older sister. And this is really the third significant death, maybe the fourth. I go back to my mother since I took to the Dhamma. And, you know, I'm saddened. I knew it was coming. So when I got the call, it was a feeling of sadness came over me. But nothing like, you know, how, no loss, no anger, no fear of what's going on or where she's going or anything like it was. And, you know, so I know from my own experience, I used to have a terrible fear of death. I couldn't think of anybody. I just couldn't imagine people dying. I couldn't go to, like, funerals were always really difficult because I couldn't stand seeing somebody in that box because of the self-reflection.
Right.
And, I'm not going to say going to funerals is pleasant, or the phone call last Saturday was pleasant. It wasn't. But I felt what was appropriate. And I can't help but notice that, that this is just what this feels like without embellishing it. Yeah. So they're great questions. And so to answer them, I can only speculate as to what the Buddha felt, but I can tell you from my own experience the difference in me now. And it's remarkable. I would bet that the Buddha didn't wallow in any kind of despair, though. Yeah. Or confusion.
Or change,
because the unwinding, again, that's really the understanding of death, isn't it? It is just change.
Yeah.
You know, it's noticeable and remarkable and often hurtful, but it is just change, and we all know it's coming.
You don't become an autotron, and you don't have appropriate sadness that someone passed, but you don't react in a manner that's
devoid of feeling.
Devoid.
Yeah, hiding your... Yeah, and I would, you know, from my own experience, no. You know, and why would you? An awakened human being is simply a fully mature human being, so, which means you are in full control of your feelings. So you'll feel, the Buddha says it in the Vitakasanthana Sutta, you gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it, meaning your thinking at any point is appropriate for what's occurring. And sadness over losing a loved one is an appropriate feeling. There's nothing. It's only when it gets to the discriminating, craving, and clinging. I can't live without you. How could this happen? She's, you know, all the things that might go through our minds. It's just what occurs, and it's not just then. It's not just when we lose loved ones. That understanding is a broad but very definite understanding of the nature of suffering, isn't it? This is one of the examples of aging and death, but there's all the others that are common in the world. We had, I think, this discussion on Saturday about the ills of the world, and how do we, and it comes up occasionally on Saturday too, what do we do with all the, how can we just do this when there's all these problems in the world? Well, the problems in the world the Buddha described in the First Noble Truth, and they're rooted in ignorance. So if we're really concerned about all the issues in the world today, and we should be, I am, the most effective thing we can do is to end ignorance in ourselves first, so maybe we can share that wisdom with others. But if we don't do it in ourselves first, we don't have a chance, do we?
Yeah, maybe we can do something effective with a clear eye.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be caring and compassionate prior to awakening, but we should also understand our limitations prior to awakening. I would say that the condition of the world deserves wisdom applied to it and not further ignorance, because we've been doing that. We've been trying to solve our problems and maintain ignorance at the same time, and it's not working, is it? Yeah, it's not working. So we should try something else, but I don't know if we're going to try this. I'm going to send a few more copies of the book out there. Never got a response from the last two White Houses, but I'm not surprised. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of sickness, aging, death, sorrow, pain, distress, despair, and confusion. Wisdom brings a cessation of the entire mass of stress and suffering. We did the Paticca Samuppada in one sitting, despite all my commentary. Wisdom brings a cessation. The Buddha starts out this sutta with saying ignorance is the problem and wisdom is the solution. And how do we gain wisdom? It is, and it really is, I'm not trying to be, it really is that simple, but there's a lot to consider as we do that, you know, as we develop that understanding. And now we understand clearly the process of our own ignorance ending up in giving birth to, excuse me, confusion, deluded thinking. Excuse me. And stressful moments in our life. And it's just a normal human condition, isn't it? The condition of suffering is dependent on certain other conditions, beginning in ignorance. And it's just that simple. So let me ask Jane to come on. Jane, you got anything to say tonight? Hey, Jane?
Yes, I'm here.
There you are.
Hi. No, I just reflect back on when I first heard Dependent Origination.
I was going to ask you.
I was laughing. It was just totally, you know, at some point I just stopped trying to follow along. And now my understanding is such that I was able to follow, you know, to the end. So.
Yeah, outstanding. Yeah. Thank you, Jane. Would anybody else describe their relationship with Dependent Origination that way?
Yes.
The first 150 times you heard it?
Right.
And then it just starts making sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So now you know why I keep saying the same thing over and over again. Glad you joined us tonight, Jane. Matt, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see everyone here. I'm just going to take note of silence tonight.
Glad you're here. Lorna.
That's what I was going to do. I was going to say that I'm just going to bask in the teaching and not sort of focus on something, just take the whole visual in and sit in noble silence. Thank you.
Glad you're here. Kevin,
nice
good to see
be
you.
Here, John. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. Well, now that we got that out of the way, I don't think I have anything to add.
Thank you. Good evening, Ron.
Good evening. It always feels overwhelming to me to face the Dependent Origination, this sutta itself.
Still?
Well, it's less overwhelming, and it's... there's more of a continuity to it now. Every step on the way is less of a oh it's that, and to like oh yeah right then and then goes to there. And I also see that there's all these people referencing it back to the three marks of existence, every step of the way. That's still quite a challenge. But yeah, it's somewhere along the line it'll be a whole, and where I, you know, where the understanding becomes. But you know, that's that'll be the end point basically. Yeah. Once you get to see the whole of Dependent Origination, that's it.
Right. It makes a lot more sense now than it used to.
Oh yeah. It was completely flabbergasting. I think the first one was the first time really was during the first retreat.
Uh-huh.
Although I'd had a taste of it because I'd started to read the middle length discourses already that summer. And I remember going through that list, and I was looking at it from one specific perspective that made it a little bit easier to see it. But that first retreat was both an exposition on Dependent Origination and the five clinging aggregates.
Yeah.
And both of them were overwhelming at that time.
Mm. Yeah, that was the focus was becoming empty of clinging. Mm-hmm. And that was the point, but they're all kind of the same thing. So. Thank you, Ron. Hello, Mary. Good to see you.
Hi, everybody. So you do know what Mrs. Obama named her book?
Yeah, she.
I'm
she,
just saying.
She stole it from me.
It's not without some influence.
But it's called Becoming Michelle. Is that? The
no, it's a different kind of becoming. Right. I think it is just becoming.
I think it's just becoming.
Yeah, yeah. But it's her path, and she's not. She admits she's not found her path yet. So. Liz did a really beautiful thing this weekend. She facilitated a conversation between artists that had survived and healed from some kind of, you know, most of it were cancers. There were probably about eight people on the panel, and their artwork was all around the room. And Liz facilitated a dialogue with, you know, the people who attended, but also had a series of questions, very thoughtful, intentional questions about their journey and, their experience with art and healing and all of that. It was fabulous and not something I would have gone to had it not been, you know, something she was involved with, mm-hmm. because it's all about death, but it's not about death. It's all about them coming out the other side and living. Anyway, it was very fascinating and beautifully done, and you can hear her practice in the questions that she asked and the follow-ups and all of that. So it was so beautifully done, and really beautiful stories too, because you know, you think about things like cancer, mm-hmm. but people survive and they come out the other side and then they go on with their lives.
Mm-hmm. Where was it?
At the Monmouth Museum. And yeah, a woman who had come to one of her shows or had been involved in one of her shows asked her to facilitate this. So. Anyway, fascinating, and again, outside of something I would have normally gone to, so really, really nice. You know, dependent origination, at the first retreat I went to, you know, I remember that experience of not full comprehension, but certainly realizing that a different direction and a different understanding of becoming and what that meant, and the release and shearing of so many, you know, just thoughts and fabrications and expectations for my life and the people around me. I mean, it was a long list of things that fell off that night. you know, I could never, I don't think I could teach it to anyone. I still have work to do, you know, to understand it and to fully integrate it. And just sort of a repeating theme for me right now is, just, you know, there are times when you have the direct experience of knowing in the phenomenal world a certain concept, an understanding and appreciation. And then there are times when it's just hard in the phenomenal world to apply, to keep all of this top of mind. I'm not even sure those are the right words, but they can be at odds, and odds with each other, the phenomenal world and these teachings, for me right now, right? Because I know at some point they won't be at odds. But there are like a lot of concepts and fabrications and, yeah, I guess those are the best words I've got, that are normal in the phenomenal world or in the working world for me, that, you know, you get used to, you adopt, you adapt, and then you spend the rest of your life trying to shed them all and still survive in that phenomenal world, as opposed to just abandoning it, right? That could have been an option for me over the last couple of months. I could have said, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore, and I'm going to go do that. But, you know, it would have been hard to put a roof over her head. So, you know, so you do what you have to do. But anyway, a lot of words. But trying to narrow the gap in my understanding and my direct experience with the Dhamma in the phenomenal world, and really just trying to have right view. I guess that's all I'll say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very well said. David, good to see you.
Well, John, thank you for your teaching.
Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm a little tired tonight. I think listening to this, I think it gets overwhelming, or, you know, so you start shutting down a little bit, but I had to, an experience this week where, well, it's already only Tuesday, but
a lot of week
yesterday, where I had something that I've been wrestling with. And I think maybe what happened was that I was able to cut a chain and let go of the way I want it to be and accept things as they are. And I was able to have an extraordinary paradigm shift that allowed me to do some of my work even with more ease and with almost joy. And then I woke up this morning and was like, oh, really? But really, and even if I vacillate a little bit backward, I don't know what it was that allowed me to sever or to put one of the chains. So and I think something happens, and then things fall away, and then I can move forward and really do what I'm being asked to do in some way. So it's really. And it felt really good because it was a relief.
Yeah. Thank you, Bonnie.
You're welcome.
Do you, that falling away that you described, do you recognize, and it's okay if you don't, but do you recognize the Dhamma you were practicing at that point of contact,
uh-huh.
that you were
yeah.
integrating?
Well,
and it's not just,
it wasn't in the beginning of the contact. It's been contact for a while. But because it was still involved, and it's a complicated thing at school, but I think all along I was in it, and then when I really applied the Dhamma, you know, not in a really even a conscious way, but just knowing that I didn't want to be, that what I, how I was trying to solve this problem and listening to how other people were going to solve the same problem, I had to step back from sort of like the negativity, even if I still experience some of that which arises. But yeah, so it was really understanding that I was really trying to have intention, like it was really about having a skillful intention and what needed to occur. And it was really, was this last night? No, it was Sunday night. It was really.
Yeah, and the point I'm making, and you just mentioned it, right, intention, is by the developing, excuse me, the framework of the Eightfold Path that allowed you in that situation to apply it. And that's just how it is.
And you know, intention might be the one that rises to the surface, but it's all the other things that have to be in place in order to see it and to be able to figure out how I'm going to speak to it and not and allowing myself to do it in my way and not having to do it the way some of my other colleagues were addressing some of these issues. So
it's just
like
that.
Everybody will, you know, hopefully those that are involved with this, everybody will benefit. And if everybody benefits, then it's not a good thing.
Yeah, I think so. Thank you, Bonnie. Our retreat begins a month from tomorrow. There's still room. If you haven't paid for your room yet, please do so as soon as you can. That helps me a lot. I think that's it. Can't think of anything else. Matt has Qigong next Saturday?
This coming Saturday.
Yeah. It's a great way to spend a Saturday morning. What am I trying to do? Metta. Like a well-concentrated mind. We'll finish with metta as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditative posture. Take a moment or two to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Thank you, Jane, for joining.
Thank you, John. Have a good week.
You too.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Yes, thank you. You get better and better and better and better.
Really?
I'm getting this down.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.